How malleable is your memory? New research from Iowa State University shows it's possible to manipulate an existing memory simply by suggesting new or different information. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, my guest is Jason Chan, an assistant professor of psychology at Iowa State University. He'll tell us why the timing and recall of an existing memory is key to manipulating it. Then in the second half hour, we'll hear how long-term care facilities and independent caregivers approach the memory of the elderly. We'll find out how memories are uncovered and how they diminish in people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementia. That's all coming up this hour, right after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How malleable are existing memories? This hour is all about memories. In the first half hour, we'll look at new research from Iowa State University showing that it's possible to manipulate existing memory by, well, as can be as simple as suggesting new or different information. Joining me to discuss the new study and how memory works, Jason Chan, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Iowa State University. Jason Chan, welcome to our program. You're in our AIM studio.
Hi, Ben.
Thank you for being with us. Before we get into your study, the goal you had with this study, give us the basics, the basic stages of memory. Walk us through how it works.
The basic stages of memory usually is conceived of three stages, and this has been the way that we've understood memory for many years, from the study of neurobiology of memory all the way to the behavioral studies of memory, where the first stage is what we call encoding, where when you basically that's when a memory is formed, is when you experience new events and your brain encode those events. Afterwards, the second stage is to turn those perception into memory, and that's what we call storage. And sometimes in neurobiology terms, that's called consolidation of a memory. And then when you want to recall an experience or when you want to relive an experience, that's the third stage. It's called retrieval. The idea is that you take that memory back out and put it back into your conscious experience.
Okay. So with that in mind, what did your team set out to do?
So for a long time, neurobiologists believe that a memory, once it's formed, once it's consolidated, it stays stable and resistant to changes. So when you retrieve a memory, it just retrieves that memory. It doesn't really do anything to it. But newer research over the past 10 or so years have discovered that when you retrieve a memory, even if it has been consolidated, it will actually take that memory back into a labile state. It's almost like turning an old memory back into a new one, where it's actually particularly malleable. Research with animals, non-human animals such as rats and fish and snails, have found that once a memory is reactivated, it can be sort of wiped out by a protein blocker. When you form a new memory, you need to produce protein synthesis to make that memory stable. And when you reactivate that memory and then you inject a protein blocker into the brain, it can actually wipe out that memory in non-human animals. Now, we can't do that with humans because we can't inject a protein blocker directly into that area of the brain where the memory is stored. So researchers have been looking for ways to use non-invasive method to take advantage of this reconsolidation window, this window of plasticity of that memory, and try to manipulate that memory. So that's one of the goals of my research, is to find out if a reactivated memory, even if the memory was originally formed days ago, can it be altered by misleading information after it's recently been reactivated.
Okay, so can you give me an example of something that perhaps many of us have experienced, and then talk about the window in which it could, during which it could be changed, the factors that go into making it malleable again?
Sure. Let's use an example for, you're a student and you go into a lecture and you were learning something about climate change. And let's say you learn that increased concentration of carbon dioxide or CO2 is one of the reasons why we have increased temperature. And you learn that in the lecture, and then later on, let's say a couple of days later, you're preparing for an exam and you form a study group with your classmates. And you're quizzing each other, and your classmate told you that asked you, oh, what is the type of gas that is increase in the atmosphere and that can lead to increase in temperature? And you, in so doing, you try to retrieve that memory, right? So when you retrieve that memory, that reactivates the memory. Let's say you try to retrieve it and you think it's O2, okay, instead of CO2,
mm-hmm.
And then your classmate tells you, oh, it's actually nitrogen. Okay, let's say he gave you wrong information, and that happens probably quite often in study groups. And once you retrieve that memory, and let's say you make it labile or makes it malleable, even if you retrieve the correct information, even if you had retrieved CO2 and then you're given incorrect information, that incorrect information, what we have found in this study, is that that incorrect information can sort of update your original memory. It makes it much harder for you to retrieve the correct memory later.
Mm-hmm. So when memories are least malleable is when? Is there a time when retreeving them is more likely to be 100% rather than being reshaped?
Typically, if we want to talk about when a memory is the freshest, it's usually when it's least likely to be changed. But that's a tricky situation because when we think about memory being particularly stable, it's probably right after it's formed, right? So you still have it in your short-term memory. It's very unlikely for you to make a mistake if I tell you, remember this number, 321.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, you remember 321 really, really well, but that's just because you still have it in your conscious awareness. Once you get distracted and that memory is no longer in your short-term store, that memory, it's pretty much labile for a long time until it's consolidated. But what recent research have shown that's particularly exciting is that even a stable memory, once it's reactivated, even if it's long after it was formed, it can become manipulated again.
What did you find in this study, Jason Chan, to be most surprising? Anything here that is new for you or others who are studying this?
Well, so in the study of, for example, with non-human animals and even with humans, in the tradition of what we call reconsolidation research, one thing that hasn't been found was that was being able to manipulate declarative memories, which is the type of memory that people usually think about memory when the type of memory that you can verbalize, that you can talk about. So if I ask you, what did you do last weekend? And you can talk about it. That's declarative memory. There are many different types of memory, such as a memory of a fear, which is typically considered conditioning. So if you, if you have, let me use an experience that I had before.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, I was watching this TV show, 6 Feet Under, and in one episode, one of the main characters picked up a hitchhiker, and it turned out the hitchhiker was a very bad person and did something really bad to him. And I've never seen that actor before until that video, until that TV show. But later on, if I see that actor again, even if he's playing a good person in a different role, I'll feel uneasy about that person, even if I cannot remember why I feel uneasy about that person. So there's some fear that I've associated with this particular person's face, even if I cannot remember where I've seen that person.
And this is a different type of memory than the declarative, which you dealt with in this particular case.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And another type of memory sometimes we call skill or procedural memory is, for example, you know how to ride a bike or you know how to swim. But if someone asks you, well, how do you balance on a bike? You can't verbalize it. You just know how to do it. That's another type of memory.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what are the implications of these findings? What could it perhaps be used for if we want to alter, reshape memories? These are some hints on how to do it, these study findings. Could it help people with troubling memories? For instance, returning veterans who have PTSD?
That would be the sort of the ultimate dream scenario for this type of research, and this is the reason why this type of research is exciting in the field. I mean, over the past 10 or so years, it's generated hundreds of studies. And at this point, it's unclear whether it's possible to manipulate very traumatic memories for people who have PTSD. But based on what we know about human memory research over the past 20, 30 years, is that most memories, even if memories that are of very, very significant events, very salient events, they change over time, just like a mundane memory. So, for example, most people believe that they remember extremely well where they were, what they were doing around the time of 9/11. So let's say you saw what happened on 9/11 on TV. You remember exactly where you were. You remember what you were doing right before that. You remember what you were doing after that. But even this type of memory, very, very significant events, these memory changes over time too. People just don't realize it.
How, in certain particular ways?
I don't know. What do you mean by
Well, do we all have, say, memories of 9/11 change in similar ways, or the changes that we undergo all individual based on other factors?
I would imagine that different factors will affect people relatively similarly, but everybody's memory has some idiosyncrasies that they will change over time differently from one person to the next.
Right, right. 9/11 is an event that we all experienced, and we knew at that moment the import of it.
Right.
We knew it was horrendous. We knew it was life-changing, world-changing. But memories of things that we only find out, let's say, the people in the Boston Parade or that Boston Marathon who were standing there before the bombs went off and then were questioned later by police and said, did you notice someone, the man next to you, did he have a backpack on, for instance? A memory where you don't know at the time that it's significant, but then later it is.
Yeah, I would imagine that this type of memory will be even easier to be manipulated. In fact, a lot of the times, most people do not know that they're witnesses to important crimes. So, for example, the Oklahoma City bomber, many years ago, he was buying these things to make explosives from just a hardware store, and he visited a hardware store multiple times. And later, when police go and question the people who are working at the store, of course, they had no idea what the guy looks like, and they kind of have to reconstruct from the bits and pieces of memory what they remember. And it's pretty easy for people to make mistakes during those situations.
If I have a memory that I don't like, can I change my own memory of something? How would I do it if so?
I think people regularly do this quite often. And one way that people typically do if they have a memory that they don't want to remember is to just try not to think about it. And that sounds a lot easier than it is, because people typically are very bad at suppressing thoughts that they don't want to think about.
Yeah, don't think about the pink elephant. Right?
Exactly. That's the first thing that comes to mind. But what we have what research has discovered recently is that a better way to try not to think about something is to use substitution. So instead of thinking about a pink elephant, maybe you want to think about a white bear. So whenever the thought of a pink elephant is about to come up, you try to think about something else as a substitute. And that some research has been done over this over the past few years, and it seems to be much better. People are much better at doing that than just trying to suppress a thought.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that non-human animals had memories, specific memories erased by injecting them with, I think you said it was some sort of blocker at certain times. Is there any reason to believe, but this would not have been tried on humans, of course. Is there any reason that this wouldn't work that you can think of on humans?
Well, the protein blocker, if we were really to open up the skull of a person and then inject it into the somewhat equivalent region in the human brain, it's completely toxic to a human. It will kill the person. But there are some other types of drugs that can also serve as a protein blocker, but it works on a systemic level, which means that you can't target a specific part of the brain for it to work, which is propranolol, pills. So some researchers have done that as well, where they have people reactivate a fear memory, which is basically an object that's associated with mild electric shock. And then they, but right before that, they take the propranolol pill, which is supposed to inhibit protein synthesis, which is important for forming memories. And what they found in those type of research is that people still remember the stimulus that's associated with the electric shock, but when they see the stimulus later, they no longer exhibit the same type of freezing response or the same types of heightened skin conductance, which is basically associated with fear, to these type of stimulus. So it seems to even this type of pills has some promising findings.
If you've just joined us, Jason Chan is my guest this first half hour as we talk about altering memories. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Iowa State University and on a author of some new research along with his team showing that it's possible to manipulate an existing memory simply by suggesting new or different information on different factors available important to do this, the timing, the recall of this existing memory. Jason Chan, what would you say are some of the great unanswered questions still about how our memories work?
Oh, there are many, many great unanswered questions. For the type of research that I focus on, I would think one of the important questions would be, for example, well, how far can we take sort of this type of memory-changing techniques? What are the boundary conditions for which we can change memories and we cannot change memories? Another big question for a lot of researchers is what can we do, for example, to help older people improve their memory? We know that older people don't remember as well, and they are easier to it's easier for people to suggest new memories to them that are false. It's easier for them to forget information that actually or events that actually happened. But what are some of the things that we can do to help older adults remember better, just like when they were younger? Mm-hmm. So some of those questions are big, important questions that a lot of researchers are tackling.
Do we know if our dreams have any influence on our memories?
It depends on precisely what you mean by that question. Typically, some pretty exciting research over the past few years is to look at the role that sleep plays rather than dreaming per se, but what does sleep do to our memory? And one idea that's receiving emerging literature support is that when people go into sleep, even before they hit REM sleep, the brain is trying to replay the events that happened during the day so that it can consolidate those memories.
Mm. Okay. Now, when we talk about care of memory, and in our next half hour, we want to be talking about exactly the topic that you mentioned, older people and how we can uncover perhaps long-forgotten memories or care for our memories into old age. How do you, or do you, Jason Chan, care for your memory?
Well, I typically think of myself as not very good at remembering things. And I think nowadays, for most people, the easiest things for people to do to try to keep a record of themselves. And a lot of people already do that without knowing what that they've been doing. That is, we have cell phones, we have these devices that are on us all the time, and we're recording our lives. I mean, you can probably trace back your life pretty easily just by looking at the emails over the years. So that really helps. But one thing that I tell my father and my mother and my in-laws is that as you approach older age, one of the best things you can do for your memory is to do physical exercise. So over the past few years, a lot of very exciting research has been showing that physical exercise that increases your heart rate, specifically aerobic type of exercise, can really delay the onset or the severity of the deficits in memory or other types of cognitive functions.
Mm-hmm. What about diet?
I imagine that diet will help too. Anything that will help you reduce the chances of hypertension will help.
Mm-hmm. What about brain, not physical calisthenics or exercise, but brain puzzles, brain calisthenics?
those things also help. We know that people with more years of education, for example, we know that people with more years of education tend to have a lower likelihood of developing dementia into later life. So that does help too. But the exciting thing about physical exercise is that the amount of improvement you get from doing physical exercise on cognitive functions is pretty huge, even compared to doing brain puzzles.
Hmm. Here's a question I'm sure you've gotten at a party. How is deja vu explained?
There are a number of theories for this, and one idea is that when we remember events, we don't remember the whole thing. We believe that we have this feeling that we do, but not only is our brain incapable of remembering entire events, we basically just remember bits and pieces. So right now I'm experiencing this studio, for example. I'm here and I'm talking to you, and I feel like I have a good understanding of where I am and all the things around me. And later on when I try to remember it, I feel like I remember everything. But I only actually really remember very few things. And in fact, our brain is not capable of paying attention to everything. We don't even see everything. And our attention really has a lot of holes in it. And we remember just bits and pieces, and we try to reconstruct those bits and pieces. And so deja vu experience can be explained by when you see a new when you experience a new event and you feel like you've experienced it before, it could be just parts, bits and pieces of that those events remind you of a past experience. And when you reconstruct the current experience, you feel like it's something that you've experienced before, just because a few things
something
matches.
Yeah, there are enough matches to make it feel familiar to you.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Tell us in the remaining minute or so that we have what you hope to study in the future. What will you build on after this these studies, a series of studies about manipulating existing memories?
So one of the main goals of my research is to look at memory changes or the malleability of memory per se. And one thing that I want to do in the future is to look at what can we do to help people improve their ability to resist changes to existing memories, or what can we do to help people be more accurate about assessing their memory. That is, if you recall something, if people ask you how confident are you that this is true, people are not that great at being able to accurately report whether their memory itself is accurate. And I want to find out ways to improve that.
Mm-hmm. I imagine very valuable research for people involved in courts, trials, and so forth.
Exactly.
Okay. I want to thank you very much. Jason Chan is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Iowa State University. Jason, tell us, where can people find this study? It was in a periodical.
It's in the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences.
Jason Chan, thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we'll talk more about our memories. We'll hear how long-term facilities and independent caregivers approach the memory of the elderly. We'll find out how memories are uncovered, how they diminish in people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementia. And if you'd like to join our conversation, do so. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Talking about memories this hour, capacity to remember something, to recall it in all its vividness this hour. I'm Ben Kiefer here on River to River. In the first half hour, we talked about the latest research on altering memories, some new research. If you want to check that out, of course, we put our podcasts online within a couple hours after the show. This half hour, we want to hear how long-term care facilities and independent caregivers approach the memory of the elderly. Also to find out how memories can be uncovered and how they diminish in people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementia. Joining me, first of all, Christine Sutton is joining me by phone. Christine, are you there?
I am.
Hi, welcome to our program. You wrote a book. The title of the book is Stop and Smell the Garbage, A Caregiver's Story of Survival And this book came 3 years after full-time caregiving for your husband, Gary, who died in late 2011 from early onset Alzheimer's disease. And your book deals with some of the issues faced by caregivers, people with Alzheimer's, other advanced dementias, other terminal illnesses. And you will be in Iowa City for a June 12th event in participating in a family caregiver community book read on Wednesday of this week at the Iowa City Public Library from 2 to 4 p.m. Welcome to our program, and tell us, first of all, a little bit about your husband, about Gary, and the onset of his illness.
Well, Gary was a very active family physician, and ironically, his subspecialty was geriatric medicine. He loved taking care of elderly people, and he was extremely active. He was a marathon runner. He was 6 feet tall. He never weighed over 175 pounds his whole entire life. There was no known Alzheimer's in his family at all. But the problem with the diagnostic process for him was that Gary was well known for being absent-minded.
Throughout his whole life.
Throughout his whole life, he was the absent-minded professor, and he could remember a patient's lab result for 2 years, but he may not have been able to recall the person's name. And when I look back, of course, hindsight truly is 20/20. But when I look back, I see that he was showing signs for at least 18 months before he was finally diagnosed, and probably 2 years. But individually, the things that he did were not that unusual for him. It was when I put them all together in retrospect and thought of them in totality that it painted really a picture of something that was far from normal.
How did you separate what you describe as Gary's normal sort of character of being a bit absent-minded from this early onset Alzheimer's disease? Was there a particular instance? I know it was a collection of things that finally dawned on you?
No, it absolutely did not. And there was just no reason to suspect that he had Alzheimer's. And when the doctor looked at us and said he has Alzheimer's, I was absolutely shocked. But as I said, when I look back, and I'll just give you one example that was pretty startling, but I didn't know about it until later. Doctors have to be recertified in their specialties every 10 years, and that means they have to take the boards again. So, and Gary had jokingly remarked to me one time, if I ever score less than 90% on the family practice board, you'll know something's wrong with me. And after he died, I was going through some of his things, and I found a file folder that had the very first time he took the family practice boards right out of medical school, and he scored 99%. And when he retook them in July of 2006, he scored 59%.
59%.
Yes, and I did not know about it at the time. All he told me was, I passed.
Your husband, a physician, now he knew more than most very well what he was facing when he was diagnosed, didn't he?
He did. He knew exactly what was ahead of him, and he made it very clear to me and to some of his friends and his colleagues that he wanted nothing done, at the end of his illness when his quality of life was poor. So we had living wills and powers of attorney for healthcare decisions and all those things.
What were some of the biggest challenges for you as a caregiver in dealing with the memory problems, the deterioration?
At first, even right, he was diagnosed in October of 2007 when he was 56, and
only 56 years old. That's amazing.
He was 56, which is why we, at least I did not suspect Alzheimer's. But even right after his diagnosis, his short-term memory was severely compromised, and he had particular trouble with anything involving numbers, names, dates, phone numbers, addresses. And he would ask me, it seems hard to believe, but he would literally ask me the same question 25 or 30 times over the course of a couple hours. And before I received some advice, I was answering him every time. And, you know, that starts to get extremely stressful.
Right. What should you have done? What is the better approach?
The neurologist said answer the question twice, and there's simply no future in answering it any more times than that. So I would just simply say, well, you're smart, figure it out, or, you know, I would just leave the room. And I noticed he started asking, a lot of the times it was about a social engagement that we might have coming up, so I started writing our social engagements in black magic marker and taped it to the refrigerator. So then I would say, go to the refrigerator. But later on, he wanted to help me around the house. You know, we're talking about a physician who worked a 60-hour week was a light week for Gary. And all of a sudden, there he is at home with nothing to do. And he felt useless, and he wanted to help me around the house. But as his dementia progressed, it became just extremely difficult. He couldn't even... For example, I called it a two-step task. He couldn't even complete that. So that an example of that would be, I would say, Gary, go down into the basement and bring up the vacuum cleaner. Well, he would go to the basement. By the time he got down there, he forgot why he was there, and came back up empty-handed. So it was hard to deal with his desire to help me and his inability to complete even the simplest task.
If you just joined us, Christine Sutton is with us, author of the book Stop and Smell the Garbage, a caregiver's story of survival, 3 years of full-time caregiving for her husband, Gary, who died in 2011 from early-onset Alzheimer's disease. Stop and Smell the Roses, of course, is what we usually say. Why Stop and Smell the Garbage in your case, Christine?
That came from something Gary did just a few months before he... He spent the last 15 months of his life in a nursing home, so he lived 4 years and 3 months altogether. But right before he went to the nursing home, we were walking our dog, and we took a lot of long walks because it was a real stress reliever for me, and it was for Gary, too, because anxiety was one of the hallmarks of his disease. So we were walking the dog, and we went through an apartment complex, and there was a big garbage can. And I had just sort of been talking to the dog because Gary, at that point, you know, I was never sure he even knew where he was. You know, his dementia was so severe. And the dog, you know, pulls me over to the garbage can, and I kind of said, oh, are you going to stop and smell the garbage? Well, Gary was listening, and he walked up to the garbage can, and he took off the lid, and he took a big whiff. And of course, that was one of the very few times I was able to laugh. And by then, I was more accustomed to the things that would happen. But at first, I thought, well, if I write a book, I'll put that in a chapter about the humorous aspects of Alzheimer's, because it is funny sometimes. And then I started thinking more about it, and I decided that incident really symbolizes searching for meaning when life dumps a pile of garbage on you.
Mm. Christine Sutton, hang on, please. We want to introduce also to our conversation Beth Fleming is with us by phone, Division Director of Operations at Bickford Senior Living Group. Beth, are you there?
I am.
Hi. You've been on the line. You've been listening this whole hour, I believe. You are also a member of the Iowa Center for Assisted Living on the board of directors there, a nonprofit trade association. And also with us, Diana Lane is with us, Director of Health Services at Tallman Square. That's a dementia-specific assisted living facility, part of Western Home Communities in Cedar Falls. Diana, are you there? Diana should be in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Diana. Well, we'll hope we'll get that patched up and have Diana joining us soon. Let me start with you, Beth Fleming. In your facilities, how do you encourage... memories back into people's present day lives who are in your facilities, or help them along and enjoy the memories that they have?
Well, that's a great question. And one thing that we do is, you know, first of all, we at Bickford and, you know, most caregivers in the state of Iowa, we realize that we do not, that the residents don't live in our reality. We live in theirs. And that's one thing that we have to always be mindful of. And so one way that we try to invoke memory is using either a memory basket or a memory box. And the memory baskets are just a conglomeration of different things from a certain topic that we could use to talk to our residents about things that would invoke something from their memory from their past.
Can you give me some examples? Yeah.
Yeah. For example, we have in our Burlington Bickford, we use a baking basket, and it's stuff that I picked up at the local Salvation Army, so they're not at all expensive to make. We just found some old cookie cutters and old aprons and an old wooden rolling pin and an old nut crusher, which most people don't know what those are anymore, but our residents sure do. And so we grab that basket and we get those things out and we start talking about, well, what is this? You know, we kind of play what we call the stupid card. And we say, well, what are these things? What do you use this for? You know, did you ever use one of these, you know, with your kids, or did your mom ever use one of these? And just really start asking them questions. And as the resident holds that item, you know, and they really start thinking about it, that will invoke those memories, you know, in that long-term memory that, you know, might have been lost in the disease process.
Mm-hmm. And do you see often joy expressed when you tap into a memory that perhaps hasn't been tapped into for decades?
Absolutely. And it's especially, you know, it's especially meaningful when we have maybe some family members there with their loved one, and we are maybe using a memory basket or looking at pictures or something, and it invokes a memory, and they start talking about it that maybe their children have never heard of, or they hadn't heard mom talk about that in a long time, and it's a very special moment for them to bring those memories back out of the fog.
I suppose there are also cases when painful memories can be dredged up.
Absolutely. You know, you never know, and that's the risk that you take with these memory baskets, is that you never know, you know, what kind of memory that you could invoke. It could invoke something, you know, well, gosh, I hate that because my mom used to make me, you know, be outside and wash the clothes in the freezing cold, you know, and if you had an old washboard, that might invoke something, you know, that's not so pleasant. And so then you kind of would steer away from that and move on to something that you would hope would invoke a more memorable or pleasant memory for them.
Mm-hmm. Do you have other tools that you can name that you work with?
Yeah, one of the things that we also use is more of a personal touch for individual residents, and they're called memory boxes. And it's a very similar to what it looks like, a very thick picture frame with shelves that's hung outside each resident's apartment. And what we ask families to do are put things in there for the residents to use as a visual cue, not only to find their apartment, but also to invoke some memories. And it might be, for example, we have a resident who was a huge farmer and loved John Deere. So he would put they would put little John Deere tractors and dried pieces of the corn from, you know, like field corn in there, and just anything that might remind him of being on the farm, and that's his spot, that's his apartment, because there are my things, there's my John Deere tractors, and there's the field corn, and, you know, there are different things like that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Beth Fleming, if you see recalling memories, triggering memories like this, like you've described, as certainly there is enjoyment, and that has a value in itself. Is there a value past that? Do, for instance, the people in your care who relish their memories tend to be happier on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes you have to invoke that same memory every single day to get them, you know, into a happy place, because, you know, their memory is fading, or, you know, there's different levels of their memory loss. But absolutely, when you can get them into a memory that especially brings out something very positive from their past, it makes things much easier on everybody. It makes, you know, the stress level of our caregivers, stress level of the residents, and of our family members is much less when, you know, they're talking about something that can be very pleasant in their past.
Mm-hmm. Christine Sutton, let me turn to you again and ask, what tools did you use with Gary in the 3 years of his life after the diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's disease?
Well, I did use some tools similar to what Beth is talking about because, as I mentioned, a hallmark of Gary's disease was anxiety. And he would become so anxious that it was very difficult to deal with. And so none of the medications work correctly because they are tested on people with normal brains.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, Gary had a collection of record albums, and we bought a replica of an old-fashioned radio, and it had a turntable in it. So I would play his Beach Boys albums for him and his Beatles albums, and he really enjoyed that. And he had three or four favorite movies that he loved, and there was no such thing as watching it too many times, which astounded me. But he watched the same three or four movies I don't know how many times. He also had an album of photos from his childhood of him and his siblings, and he picked that up so many times in one day that I finally put a table beside his place on the couch and put that on there so it would be within reach. But it's kind of humorous. The only new movie he really took a shine to, or one he had never seen, was A Christmas Story, and that's the story about the little boy that wants the BB gun, and there was a cable channel that ran that movie continuously, I think for 48 hours over the Christmas holiday, and Gary sat for two entire days and watched that movie over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about growing up in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Did Gary then, did they trigger specific memories that he had, sharp memories from his early years, or...
Sometimes he would talk about things that had happened when he was a child, yes. And, it's my understanding that people lose their memories in the reverse order they acquired them. And so that's why the first sign of Alzheimer's is often short-term memory loss, and it's why even at the very end of the disease process, some people retain some of their long-term memories. And one example was Gary has five children from his first marriage, and he was one of five siblings. So late in his disease, when someone would ask him, what are your children's names, he would rattle off his own siblings' names.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting.
I think we've established contact with Diana Lane, Director of Health Services at Tallman Square in Cedar Falls. Diana, we have you by phone. Are you there?
I'm here, Ben.
Thank you very much. Sorry for the problems we had there in getting hooked up, but we're coming to the end of the hour. But tell us a little bit about the methods you use there at Tallman Square for triggering people's memories.
Well, tapping into all the senses is a good way to evoke those memories. And like Christine talked about, those long-term memories sometimes go clear back to childhood. So tapping into the senses such as smell and touch and visual senses and sound and taste can bring about these memories that can create a whole conversation. It may be putting on a song, and that song, just hearing that song, takes them back to maybe their wedding night. This is the song that my husband and I danced to, and that becomes a very happy, happy time, and then that can lead into other conversations about the husband and her family and all the things that are feel-good things that you want to evoke out of people with these good memories.
Mm-hmm. What do you do? I mean, as we get older, we all fear losing our memories. How do you comfort someone who is in the grips of perhaps losing a memory, Diana?
Well, that's probably one of the most difficult stages, is when you are aware that you are losing that, and it can be very, very trying for family members and definitely for the person who's going through that. I think to be supportive, really learn someone's personal history. If you're not part of the family, if you're a caretaker like I am, learning their personal history so that you can be that person who is the one that's going to help them remember. Their memories never go away, but it transfers the responsibility to us to help them remember these things. So by us bringing up these different things, we can help stir some of those good memories and be a part of that person's memory process.
Okay, Diana Lane, I'm sorry the time was so short for you. We have to go, but we do appreciate you joining us, Director of Health Services at Tallman Square in Cedar Falls. Thank you, Diana.
Thank you.
Beth Fleming, thanks to you, Division Director of Operations at Bickford Center Living Group. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you, Ben.
And Christine Sutton, thank you for joining us, author of Stop and Smell the Garbage, A Caregiver's Story of Survival. And once again, we want to mention that Christine Sutton is in a family caregiving community book read this Wednesday at the Iowa City Public Library from 2 to 4 p.m. Christine, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton in Ames. Today we had help from Jason Burns in Cedar Falls. Tony Daner helped us out. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. And joining me now, Charity Nebbe is with us, and a preview of tomorrow's show. What's coming up?
Tomorrow's one of my favorite shows of the month. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease will be here.
Oh, goody.
Yes. And we're going to talk about floods, fire, and wildlife. So we'll talk about the boom-bust cycles that a lot of wild populations go through, how humans manage populations to try to maintain a steady number of a certain type of species. It should be really fascinating.
I imagine people can call in because there are distressed animals out there that have been affected by the recent flooding, I imagine.
I think there have been a lot of visible results, yeah.
Okay, Charity, thanks for that update. Tomorrow, Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe at 10 o'clock. We always welcome your comments and questions. You can contact us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.